So once everybody is stretched and scratched and coughed and all these other things which people do to get yourselves comfortable again, I'll begin this evening's talk. And for today's talk, last Tuesday we did our annual visit up to the Benedictine Monastery in New Norcia. The Buddhist monks always go up there once a year. They come down to see us. We talk monk business, not monkey business, but monk business, because there's only two groups of monks in the whole state, and so we get on very, very well. But we always have some subject to discuss, and the subject we were discussing was just how we incorporate just the various disappointments, sufferings, anxieties, and pains of life. And how we incorporate that and understand that in our various little traditions and practices. And of course, that's one of the main reasons why people come to a temple, which is because there's always some difficulty in life, there's some pain, disappointment, and suffering. So you come to places like this to get free treatment. It's like a hospital. And I know that somebody told me that that's so common in Asian countries, that people go to the temple when they're in trouble. That many women in Thailand were not actually going to the temples anymore. And they asked why, and it was because, well, if their neighbours saw them going into the temple, that meant there was something wrong with them. And the usual thing which was wrong in Thailand was their husband was having an affair with somebody. So they thought that any time they saw somebody going into the temple, their friends would come up afterwards and say, "Oh, you poor thing, it's sad to hear about your husband having an affair." "What do you mean?" they would say. "Well, you just went into the temple. Is that what you want to see the monk about?" I said, "No, I just wanted to give an offering and be happy." But it is true that part of the reason why people come to listen to Buddhism is because it gives a great answer to the difficulties and problems and the suffering in life. It actually learns a way to overcome these things, to accept them, that this is part of life. And that's one of the first understandings about the difficulties in life is actually to expect them. You know, it happens. And what really surprises me is that people who've lived in the world for such a long time still don't really understand it. We always expect it just to always go according to plan, always for the aircraft to leave on time. And I say this because I do stupid things. I went to Melbourne yesterday on Thursday and came back this morning. Just an overnight. I like doing one-night stands, one-night gigs, giving a talk last night to a nice couple. And, of course, what happens this morning? You are tired and the aircraft is delayed for an hour and a half. Was that surprising? No, I expected that. It's called Qantas. I also expect it to be very bumpy because when I went out on Thursday, that was when there were the storms, were just the last part of the storms. My goodness, that was a very bumpy ride. But I expected that too. It's Qantas, the kangaroo. It goes bump, bump, bump. So because I expect things to go wrong, actually they don't really go wrong, I expect them to go right. I expect aircraft to be delayed. I expect turbulence in the air. I expect things always never to go according to plan. And that actually is my plan. I plan for the things never to go according to plan. If you understand that, you understand the meaning to escape suffering. In other words, so if you lower your expectations of what's going to happen in life, and just by doing that much, you can avoid so much pain and disappointment in life. Because, especially in our modern world, we expect so much from ourselves, our partners, our children, and even our monks. So sometimes you're saying, "Ajahn Brahm, I really need you." And you give me a call and I say, "I'm sorry, I can't help you today." This is one of those great Buddhist jokes. They say, ask me, so can you come and do some chanting? I've got a ghost in the house or something even worse. And I say, no, I can't come today. Why not? Because I'm busy. What are you doing, Ajahn Brahm? I'm doing nothing. That's what monks are supposed to do. We're supposed to teach by example. It's really awful when I'm rushing around. And then I'm supposed to be the quiet, the peaceful person, trying to teach you to take it easy and don't do so much. Enjoy your life without so much stress. And when you see me doing that, it's very embarrassing. But every now and again, you take some time off. And so they called me and said, can you come to my house to bust a ghost? And I say, I can't do that. I'm busy. What are you doing? Nothing. And people expect that. They never so accept that. So you can get away with it. So they call me the next day. They say, you know, can you come? Remember, I've still got a ghost in my house. Can you come and bust a ghost? And I say, no, I'm busy. And they say, what are you doing? I say, I'm doing nothing. But that's what you're doing yesterday. And I say, yes, but I'm not finished yet. Now, that is a real good Buddhist joke. And what it means is, number one, that's what monks are supposed to do. And that's what you're supposed to do as well, if you're a good Buddhist, to learn how to do nothing and relax and be more peaceful. But, you know, sometimes, even though that's why I became a monk, to have a nice time, even so, no, life never goes according to plan, does it? No, I really thought when I became a monk about 38 years ago, it's actually coming back close to my anniversary, December the 5th I became a monk, so 38th birthday next week. What day is it today? Yeah, next week. So I never expected that I'd be sitting up here talking to people. Well, I thought I'd be in some cave somewhere. I never expected, like 2-3 weeks ago, that I went to Las Vegas. Of course, you don't gamble as a monk, because that's actually one thing you're not supposed to do, and there's a good reason for that. Some of the stories which I come up with, you know, over the years are very fascinating. I don't know if I've told you this story. I've been telling it in our monastery before I actually went to Las Vegas, and just saying that why I would never go anywhere near a casino, certainly never near one of those pokey machines, because there was a famous Buddhist nun who was teaching a meditation retreat in England, and after she finished teaching the retreat, she went down to Heathrow Airport. And on the way, they stopped for something to eat. It was a lunchtime. So they stopped in one of these restaurants, which was next to a pub. If you've ever been to London, or not to London, sorry, to England, a lot of the places where you can get something to eat on a journey, they've got a pub next door. So you have to go in the front of the pub to get into the restaurant. So they went through the front of the pub to get into the restaurant and had their meal. I know the person who told me this story because she's from Sydney. And she validated this was a real story, it happened. When the driver came out of the pub, she had a few English coins spare. So she decided to put them in one of these slot machines, the pokey machines, just to get rid of the coins because... Now, the few little coins you can't change at the currency exchange. It's too small. You know, you change about £6 and you have to pay £10 commission, so you end up sort of losing on the deal. But anyhow, she put a few coins in the slot and she had one in the slot when the Buddhist nun came out from her meal. And she said to the Buddhist nun, "You have got much better karma than I have. You pull the handle." And in one moment of lack of mindfulness, just on the spur of the moment, sometimes you're thinking of something else, people ask you out of compassion, you just do it. And that's what she did. The Buddhist nun pulled the handle. And the wheels went round and round and round, and then first one stopped. Jackpot. Second one stopped. Jackpot. Third one stopped. Jackpot. Ding, 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 ding. And all this money started pouring out of the machine. And we monks and nuns were not even allowed to touch the stuff. And she couldn't afford it. It was falling all over her. She'd won the jackpot. Now, you may think that's lucky, but it's not lucky, because what happened next was all the patrons in the bar went silent. This Buddhist nun in a strange robe had won the jackpot. And the next thing which happened was the barman took a little bell and rang it and announced to the nun that it was the tradition, it was the rule which could not be broken, that whoever won the jackpot had to buy a free round of drinks for everybody in the bar. And it was the first time in 2,500 years that a Buddhist nun had to buy a whiskey, a beer, gin and tonics for all the people. And that's what happened. So that's why we've got to be really, really, really careful not to do that sort of stuff. Otherwise, we get into big trouble. But I never thought I'd be going to places like Las Vegas and doing all this other interesting stuff, which I get up to. I was just teaching meditation there. But life is full of the unexpected. So that is why that when you don't expect things to go according to your plan, exactly the way you want it to, then you don't suffer so much. So that's the first thing which we understand. I was talking to the Benedictines about it. Don't plan so much and don't have everything set forward. What might happen? Now, don't plan what's going to happen when you die. You don't know whether you're going to go to this heaven or that heaven. Wouldn't it be nice maybe when you die, you get a choice? You can go to the Buddhist heaven, the Christian heaven. So see which one you want, because this is what we have these days, you know, choices. So maybe you can actually, when you die, you can go up there and you can actually ask which one you want. Do you want to have a Buddhist heaven? What do we do in a Buddhist heaven? We could actually have nice fun, nice jokes from Ajahn Brahm every day. Maybe for some people that's a hell, I don't know. But at least you don't have too many expectations of what's going to happen in the future. And instead you can learn how to adapt. Because this is again what happens. You know, when this morning when the plane didn't go leave on time, that was fine. I could actually, there was a newspaper there, so I could read the newspaper and do the Sudoku puzzle. I'm getting old now, so I've got to look after my brain. People tell me that if you don't use it, you lose it. So I was just exercising my brain that way. Sometimes you're so peaceful and quiet, maybe the brain might slip away when you're not looking at it. So I was very active. And so you can enjoy yourself and talk to a few people. And that's a wonderful thing to do. Instead of saying, oh no, why did this happen? I'm going to be late. This is all wrong. This is actually where the suffering comes from, where we don't learn how to adapt to the changing situations of life. So I was saying one of the first things to understand is we can't predict what's going to happen. And we never say that something has gone wrong. I really don't like that word, as something has gone wrong. You know the old story, I've told it many times. Whenever you're sick, you go to the doctor, what do you say? There's something wrong with me, I'm sick. And here, hopefully, you've learned never to say that. When you go to see the doctor, there's something right with me, I've got a cancer. Is there anything wrong with having a cancer? Is it something that you've done? That you've had too much stress? You haven't eaten the right food? You haven't actually exercised? My goodness, even getting cancer, there's such a guilt trip attached to it. No, of course not. Even good people get cancers. Even monks get sick. We're really, really good. I still remember the first time I think I had a bad... I forget what it was, but anyway, I was sick. I went to the local doctors, and I was sitting in the surgery, you know, in that waiting room, waiting to be called for your appointment. And as I was sitting there, feeling really awful because I was sick, a friend came in, I think somebody who comes here, and they looked at me and said, I never expected to see you in here. And I thought, my goodness, am I in a brothel? Am I in a bar or a nightclub? I mean, what's wrong with being in a doctor's surgery? And they said, no, I thought you lived a healthy lifestyle. And I started to feel really guilty for being sick. You know, monks aren't allowed to be sick. So, no. You know, there's nothing wrong with being sick. So I'm going to fight for sick people's rights, the right to be sick. There's nothing wrong with it. And also the right for kids who've been doing all these examinations, you know, the year 12, so they're going to get their results soon. The right to be stupid and your parents get on your back for not getting high marks and not getting qualification marks to go to university. No. You have a right to be stupid, and don't discriminate against you if you're in, you know, the intelligent people and the non-intelligent. We don't have sex discrimination anymore. We don't have discrimination according to race. Gender, the age discrimination, we're trying to get rid of that. So, you know, you're not sort of sacked because you're too old. Actually, that would be very good in the Buddhist society if you sacked me, because I'm getting old now and I need a rest. But you keep on hoarding me in here. But nevertheless, and certainly my jokes are very old. They should be retired by now. But nevertheless, we still have discrimination against intelligence and lack of intelligence, thinking that somehow more intelligent people are somehow better. And there's nothing wrong with coming in the bottom half. In fact, you can probably live a much more tranquil life. There's a poem which is in my book, Open the Door of Your Heart, which I got from somewhere. And actually, I'd like to announce this because it might happen. In it. I've been telling quite a few people this. I actually emailed our committee that somebody was looking on the internet and they found that Sarah Jessica Parker of Sex in the City was actually seen reading my book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, in a cafe in somewhere in the United States. So, you know, this is like she likes these stories. So if she likes them enough, hopefully I might get a cameo in the next series of Sex and the City, which will be very interesting for what they cast a monk as. It's a nice thing to actually start thinking about. Maybe I shouldn't think too much like that. But anyway, in this story, it was actually an old Chinese little poem, but it's a famous, I forget what his name was now, a very, very famous Chinese intellectual. And it was on the birth of his son. If I can remember it correctly, it went something like this. On the birth of my son, parents, when a son is born, want it to be intelligent. But I, the father, through intelligence, have wrecked my whole life. I only hope that my boy is born stupid. And then he can live a very tranquil life, at the end of which he can become a cabinet minister. Because intelligent people, sometimes you have to think so much, you have to work so hard, and sometimes just being nice and calm and ordinary is a much, much better lifestyle than being too intelligent and having to think so much. So all your kids, if they don't do well at school, brilliant, well done. You can be. One of my favourite stories about intelligence is about one of my favourite monks, and this is a true story. One of these monks... He went to grade one at school somewhere in Thailand, and he failed grade one. Imagine that. I don't know how anyone can fail grade one. Maybe like plasticine, you know, you can't, or whatever else you do in grade one, or crayons, you know, you're not very good at that, so you have to repeat it. But anyway, he failed grade one. So all his friends went off to grade two, and he had to repeat grade one. And after another year, with the best will in the world, the teacher couldn't promote him up to grade two. So he repeated grade one for the third year. It's a true story. And after failing grade one three times, I mean, that was it. You know, they didn't have like special needs education in those days. Thank goodness for this guy, because it had a happy ending. So in the end, if you can't, you know, do well at school, it's a waste of time, like being a farmer in Thailand. You don't even know one end of a water buffalo from another. So instead, they decided the only thing to do with a boy that stupid to send him to the monastery to become a monk. Yeah, it does happen. And because in the monasteries, you know, the monks have a bit more time and they're so compassionate. And they had one of these abbots who was just really compassionate and kind, who spent all the time with this boy trying to teach him how to do the chanting. You know the chanting we do here? You know, Namo Tassa. So he's Namo what? What's the second word? Tassa. Oh yeah, Tassa. What was the first word? That was what he was like. He couldn't remember anything. And after two or three years, the abbot had enough of the boy. He couldn't do anything. The most stupidest little kid he'd ever seen. So there's only one last place they could send this boy, and that was to the forest monasteries, where I come from. But no, not all monks from the forest are like that, or all nuns as well from the forest. But when he went to the forest monastery where they teach meditation, they just told him just, you know, to watch your breath. His mind was so simple, so free of all these thoughts and ideas. He could watch his breath without any problem at all. Get into incredibly deep meditation for hours. And he soon became an enlightened being, a great teacher of meditation. And that was one of these amazing stories of the guy who was so stupid at school, but brilliant, you know, in the mind. So look, any of your kids, when they get the results, the ones who come in the bottom 5%, send them to me. This is great monks and nuns there, good material. So what we're saying, look, you don't need to suffer just because, you know, that we have this idea that, you know, the top intelligent people are better than the lower intelligent people. No, they're all good. Stupid people's rights. The next, ugly people's rights. We live in a society where everybody has to be beautiful. And you poor girls, the amount of money you have to spend, you know, on your hair. Look, shave it all off. You will never have a bad hair day ever. It's much cheaper. And just with a shaver, just when you go into the shower, it's all done in one hit. And you don't have to worry at all. And number two, if you really have to go to some party or some function, you can get a set of wigs, you know, brunette, blonde, redhead, whichever you like, and just bung it on your head. And it's very easy. And actually, you don't have to wash your hair. Just put the wig in the washing machine with all the other stuff, and it's all done. Saves so much time. So I've got all these great ideas, but ugly people's rights. And I've been trying this for a long time now. I said this here a few weeks ago. I said it last night as well. All you boys, never go out and marry a beautiful woman. Never do that. Because if you do, you will be jealous for the rest of your life. All the other boys will look at her and you'll think, are they flirting with my wife? Are they going out with her? Because she's attractive and beautiful. But if you marry an ugly girl, then you are safe for the rest of your life. You don't have to worry about a thing. She's yours. Ugly people rock. So a lot of these sorts of ideas is just actually seeing things in a different way so we don't have to suffer. And anyway, look, you know, what is beauty anyway? That so often, and this is with young girls, teenage girls, this happens so often. They come up to me and they're really, really disappointed. And they're actually depressed because they think they're ugly. And I remember this one woman came, when I first came to Perth, she said her nose was too big. And I decided, it didn't work, I decided, because I was trained as a scientist, I actually measured her nose. And I compared it to all the other girls' noses I've known in my life. And actually I told her very honestly that your nose is pretty average. You know, it's not big, it's not small, it's not sort of, you know, like a hot nose or an ugly nose, it's just a nose. But you know that didn't work. Because once you think it's ugly, as soon as you see it, it's always ugly, it's always too big. Once you think your hair is not nice, it's always not nice. But don't think like that, for goodness sake, because what we're doing, we're adding suffering onto the world by our reactions to it, the way we look at it. Now that actually is where the suffering comes from in life. It's nothing to do with life. Noses are noses, hair is hair, people are people. And you know, sometimes it's really amazing to understand, you know, what is beautiful, what is ugly, what is healthy, what is sick, you know, what is intelligent and what is stupid. It's just the way we happen to judge things in life. As I mentioned, that man who failed grade one 3 times, he was incredibly wise. But other people called him stupid. I called him incredibly wise. And some of these people, you know, who maybe they would never get sort of, or at least most people would not consider them to be attractive. They're just such beautiful human beings. To me, they're beautiful. They're not ugly. And some of these people you actually see, you know, these, sometimes you do actually see some famous people. I remember, I forget, what was it? The name keeps on escaping me. It will come back in a moment. I think Lisa McLune or something. See, she's a TV star, Lisa McLune or something. Yeah, anyway, I was teaching in a meditation class over in Sydney. And it was in a good area, I think Double Bay in Sydney. And it was only a small group. And this woman was sort of in the end of the room looking at me and smiling. And I was just wondering who the hell she was and what she was doing that for. I was a bit concerned, smiling. And afterwards, I found out she was really upset at me. Because, you know, she was this famous TV star and I never recognized her. And that's what really upsets these people. You know, I didn't know who she was. So because of that, sometimes you can see that, you know, who is the beautiful person? Who is the ugly person? For me, the beautiful person is the way that they live their life, the way they react to things in life, the kindness they have, being at peace with themselves, being at ease with life, not expecting too much, but just enjoying what we have. And this is actually where you get the idea of the secret of the overcoming of suffering in life. It's just the way we react to things. It's not the cancer. It's the way we react to it. It's not the death in the family. It's how we actually embrace this. It's not even the trauma you had when you were young. It's the way we look at it. And I said this, and this was one of the most powerful stories. This is where I leave the funny stuff and get to the serious stuff. When sometimes you have to counsel people or talk to them, women who've been raped. And that was such a difficult thing to actually to talk and see some Buddhist or some wise way of dealing with these incredibly bad experiences. Number one is because I can't get my head around that. I'm a man and I've never even come close to that experience. I can't feel it. But nevertheless, there's many other painful, difficult experiences which I've had in my life. And one of the things which I've noticed, one of the reasons why it doesn't, when you go to this counseling, why it doesn't work, is because we try and get rid of that experience. We try and deal with it in such a way that it vanishes from our past. But actually, we can't let go of it. We can't get rid of it, but we can transform it. So instead of trying to get rid of it as if it's some tumor we have to cut out and get rid of, we have to somehow embrace, find its meaning, incorporate it rather than expel it, and turn it into something beautiful. It's the old story, which I can't get past, about what you do with the shit in life, the truckload of dung. That story is, sometimes in life, it's not your fault. You go back home and you find there's a whole truckload of manure has been dumped right in front of the door of your house. And there's two things about that manure. Number one, you didn't order it. It's not your fault. And number two, no one saw the truck coming, so you can't call someone to take it away. You're stuck with it. And that's actually what life is like sometimes. These awful things happen to you, and it's not your fault. And number two, you're stuck with it. And there's two things you can do with dung. The first is you put it in your pockets, in your bags, up your shirt, down your trousers, and carry it around with you. In other words, you stink. And you find, if you carry around the dung, you lose a lot of friends. Even the people who really care for you and love you. If you keep repeating and talking about those problems, it's obvious, you know, that the best world in the world, we've got enough problems of our own. And after a while, that people get fed up with you. And it's so tough always listening to the same old stuff, the negative stuff. That is not the thing to do with dung. As you all know, the thing to do with a truckload of dung is get the wheelbarrow and the spade out, put it in the wheelbarrow, wheel it to the back and dig it into your garden to transform it. Don't try and get rid of it, but transform it. It's your garden. It's there. You can't get rid of it. You're stuck with it, but transform it. And you all know what happens when you put dung into the garden round the back. Your fruit trees get so much more fruit than ever before, and they're juicy and sweet. You get so much fruit that you give it to all your friends, you share it, and they also enjoy all the fruit of your hard work. And your flowers are so incredibly beautiful, deep-coloured and fragrant because of the powerful fertiliser of that dung. That they even come and offer those flowers to like the church or the shrine like this so other people can also enjoy them. That's a garden which you make from the dung of your life. It's a wonderful simile because you're not trying to get rid of things. You're incorporating and transforming it. So all these experiences which will happen to some people, the abortions, the rapes, the abuse which we have in our community, should never happen, but it does. What are we going to do about it? The only thing to do is don't keep it out of your heart. Bring it in. Transform it. That's the whole meaning. I'm taking some of the stories I said to you before and actually giving them the real full meaning in the context of suffering. The idea of opening the door of my heart, which, you know, is a story I've told it so many times. I won't go into detail of its origins. But the expression of love is to say to somebody, first of all, that's the easy stuff. You know, son, daughter, wherever you go in your life, whatever you do, please always remember the door of my heart is always open to you. You can come in any time. It's the idea of unconditional love, no matter what a person has done. Even if your son has committed suicide, even if your daughter has really failed her examinations, even if your best friend has let you down, no. I still love you. The door of my heart is always open to you. And of course, I've told you do that later on to yourself. Whoever you are, whatever you've done, to open that door to yourself. But that also means opening the door of your heart to your past. Even though some of it has been so painful, so difficult to bear. You know, you may have been young and had an abortion. You know, you may have, you know, wrecked your relationship by sleeping with somebody else rather than the person you've committed to. You may have done some terrible things. Instead of rejecting it, open the door in your heart and invite it in. That is part of you. And a wonderful thing happens when you open the door of your heart. You stop judging these things. You accept them. The pain starts to disappear. And it gets transformed. Instead of into guilt or anger, into learning, into wisdom. And this beautiful ability to allow, to forgive, and never let it happen again. That is the process. You know, the whole idea of the great pains in life, the meaning of that suffering, because we have to give it meaning, is to learn. To learn, to grow, and to love. And you can't love unless unless you've had enough shit in your life, basically. You can't do that. I tell a lot of young people, unless you've had your heart broken, you don't know the meaning of a relationship and what real love is or what trust is unless it's been broken. And then you understand its importance, its value. And you never allow that to happen ever again. These are actually the things which what the pain and suffering of life is there for. It's for us to learn, to grow. It is the fertilizer of our garden. And I know that from experience because there are some people who've really been through what makes my skin creep, You know, I remember going, I think she's here today. It's called ASSETS, I think, the Association of Survivors of Trauma and Torture. Some of the things which these people have been through in our world, probably going through right now in some dark dungeon of some failed state somewhere in our world. What some people endure is, you know, incredible. I don't think I could ever endure that. But when they talk about it, and the sort of person they've become as a result, it's just incredible. I remember hearing the story of some of these Tibetan monks who were tortured, you know, in some of these jails in China, and what they went through. But they learned amazingly compassion for their torturers. And that is amazing what they can do. If it's revenge you want and so-called justice, you'll just be torturing the torturers. You are in jail and somebody else goes in jail, and the jails will always become full. That idea of revenge, the justice of an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, is something which I never believed in. And it's got nothing to do with Buddhism at all. It is an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Just makes more work for the ophthalmologists and the dentists. It doesn't really stop the problem. But this idea of actually accepting, embracing, learning and transcending, growing gardens out of shit, that always appeals to me. That's how I've learned what the meaning of suffering is. So anyone who's actually in here, who's had something which they did in the past which really hurts, it's gone right inside of you and scarred, you know, the essence of you. If you want to reject it, you will never heal. If you want anger and get back at someone, there's no way forward. Or anger to yourself, guilt, thinking there's something wrong with you. What you're doing is rejecting half of yourself, keeping that outside. Invite it in. Love the enemy. And if you invite it in, an incredible change happens. Invite the rape in. Invite the torture in. That happened to you. That's who you are. Denying who you are with your history is one of the greatest reasons for suffering. Inviting it in. Being with it. Don't be afraid of it. It doesn't hurt anymore. And then you can actually grow and learn. There's one of the most moving stories was when I was in Malaysia. They asked me, can I please counsel somebody because she was in a big mess and no one had ever managed to do anything for her. Counselors, doctors, psychologists and psychiatrists. So I was one of the last throws of the dice for this woman. And I never asked what she'd been through or why she wanted to see me. I didn't want any preparation because I knew if you're going to help anybody, the less plans you have, the less knowledge, the better. So you can actually just be with a person and get right into them and find out who they are and know what to do. Because the more plans and expectations you have, the more knowledge, that actually stops you seeing the truth. That's one of my sayings. Never allow your knowledge to stand in the way of truth. So, you know, if you hear what's happened to her, then you think about it, and you're not really seeing the problem anymore. Keep your mind perfectly still and open and peaceful. So that's what I did with this woman. I just didn't know who she was and asked her, you know, what happened. And then again, one of those skin-creeping moments when she told me how she was violently raped, brutally raped. I don't know how people can do that to another human being. But it happens. And when she finished her story, you know, my mind was so still, horrified but still. The words which came out of my mouth to this day shocked me. It was automatic, not premeditated. The words came out, you're so lucky to have been raped. What did I just said? And then I looked at it and I understand why I said that. As I said, I look deep inside of you. You know, you have incredible strength, resources you haven't tapped. You know, you are going to find a way through this. And when you do, you are going to say something, be able to say something which I can never say. You'll be able to be with someone who's had that experience and tell them that I know how you feel. That's such a wonderful thing to say to someone else, to empathize with them, to say, look, you're not alone. I've been there too. I can't say that. You will be able to say that. You will be able to put your arm around, not just your real arm, your spiritual arm, and say, I know what you're going through. But you'll be able to say something even more. You'll be able to say, I know the way out of this. I know the way out of this incredibly black, dark, painful hole. Take my hand. Come. So that's why you're so lucky. You'll be able to give, heal, care, and relieve the pain of so many other women. Well, I will not be able to touch them. I can't get there. You will be able to do that. That's your meaning. Embrace. Turn that experience into your garden, which I hope she's done. And that's actually the sort of thing which I mean by this talk about the suffering. Reject it. Put it aside. Feel guilty about it. Get angry about it. And it doesn't go away. You just make more suffering and pain in life. Embrace it. I don't say like it. Embrace it. Take it on board. Dig it in. Open the door of your heart to it. Whatever you've done. Open the door. Don't close it. And that's where it's transformed. It's amazing to see it. What I don't just say these things from theory. You all know when I come up here, I don't just recite what you can read in books. This is like stuff from my experience of teaching for so many years. What I found works, what I found really works in my own heart. What makes sense from experience. And that really does. That is the meaning of suffering. That is the way out of the suffering. That's his purpose, to grow gardens, be incredible human beings. It's your chance. It's your life's work. There's not one person in this room who's had an easy life. We've all had real difficulties and problems. So, you know that when my father died, that was a huge blow to a 16-year-old. You know, I've talked about him so much. You know, he was mentor. He was my guide. He was the person I looked up to. I got so much wisdom from him. But when he died, I had to learn how to grow that into a beautiful garden. That's where I got the story about, you know, the concert, life being a concert. At the end of the concert, you never cry. I don't cry after concerts. I feel what a wonderful feeling that is at the end of a concert. You've been there, listen to this great music. That's powerful. You know the music is over, but you wouldn't have missed it for the world. All the people I've known, befriended, loved, been part of their lives, who've died, who are no longer here. Thank you for being with me. Thank you for knowing me. Thank you for being my friend, my father, my mother, all these people I've known who now died. Thank you so much. I wouldn't have missed that. That's what I learned from my father's death, for the pain of that. So I grew my garden and my flowers I share with each one of you. You can't do that unless you've been in those situations and know what you're talking about. So all the pain of your life, the difficulties, the suffering, don't reject it. It's not that something has gone wrong. It's right that happened to you. It's a powerful thing to say. It's not wrong, it's right. It happened. Let it come in. And you'll find when you stop rejecting it, the transformation starts. The garden starts to grow. It takes a lot of guts to do that, incredible courage. But basically, there's no other way. You can't keep that dung. You have to dig it in. And you become amazing beings. People say, what's the meaning of life while we're here? That's why we're here. To grow. I don't mean just to grow old, to grow stupid. I mean to grow in here, in your hearts. When you know how to grow, you know why these things happen to us. So there we go. Embracing the pain. So that's the talk for this evening. Hopefully you enjoyed it. If you didn't, and you really thought it was a bad talk, please embrace that pain. Okay, I'm sure we get a few questions after that talk tonight. Sadhu, 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 sadhu. Okay, here we go. From many places in the world. Today we've got from Glasgow, from Queensland and Singapore. That's one of the reasons I travel around all the world, because all these talks, they go online and you wouldn't believe just how many places these go to. And you wouldn't believe actually who's listening to this talk tonight. It'd be wonderful to find out some of the people you probably least expect are probably listening to this talk. But the first one is Dan from Glasgow. I can lower expectations of myself, others and life in general, but it can negatively affect my family and friends' opinion of me and how they treat me. How do I help them understand? Easy, just as I said some years ago, get a copy of my book, leave it in your house, and tell your family, keep your hands off this, this is mine. In order to get a person to actually listen to this stuff or read it, you have to use negative or reverse psychology. Tell them it's prohibited. Tell them it's R-rated. Tell them it's erotic. Anything which is banned, people will look at. So that's actually the great way to say, you know, the Buddhism is erotic or meditation is banned. And it makes it very interesting. So if we actually turn this like into Dhammaloka nightclub, you know, with flashing red lights and stuff like that, many more people come in. It'd be the same thing once you get inside, but just on the outside, just to get people to come in. But the other thing is to actually to help your friends and your family understand this, is a lot of time it's because that these things actually work. They do actually make you a happier, more balanced, even healthier person. Because once the psychology is healthy, the body usually follows and is pretty healthy too. So that you become a very impressive person. So a lot of people, I'll tell about one of my monks. I don't mind mentioning his name because he won't mind this. Venerable Nito, he was from Norway. When he first came over here to Perth to ordain as a monk, his family were really upset. They didn't want him to become a monk. Why are you becoming a monk? He had a good career. I think he was a manager of something or other, and a very good education. Why are you becoming a monk for goodness sake? So that when he went home, because his father was very sick, he showed me the letter from his mum. He says, you can come home, but please wear a suit. No robes. I'll be embarrassed to see my son in a brown, stupid robe. And so I told him to write back to his mother, it's this robe or naked. Take your choice. So he went there with a robe on. But they weren't happy. But then his father died. And so he went back, I think, to look after the family. He did the funeral service, organized everything. And then his elder brother, one of the most negative, wrote to me saying, I don't know what you've done to our brother, but carry on. Now we really appreciate, you know, what you're doing over here in Australia. We don't know what Buddhism is, but whatever it is, it works. Our brother has changed. He's such a wise, strong, compassionate person, and he's helped the whole family so much. He said, thank you. Please, the whole family, give his monkhood our blessing. It was wonderful actually to see that change over in a couple of years. Just when they saw that what these teachings actually do, they respected it enormously. And I've been telling a few of my monks, one of them went into this auto store. I saw you. Who was that? No, it was Neil. He went into this auto store in Armadale to collect some seat covers. And the people in there, they had the seat covers already ordered, but a big pack of dana, food for the monastery as well. And these were like petrol heads, he called them. And they're the last people you'd actually think were into spiritual life. I said, oh, no, you're really great, you monks. Can we come up there and offer dana? The respect you're getting now from the local community in Australia is so different when you first came here. These are ordinary, you know, the heart of our city and heart of our nation, ordinary Australians really respect us. So that's actually how you influence your family and friends, by example, by who you are and how you behave and your practice. And that is more impressive than any book. When in times of crisis and difficulty, you're at peace. Another saying, it's an old poem I read in this book when I was a student. It's easy enough to be happy when life goes along like a song. For the one worthwhile is the one who can smile when everything goes all wrong. And that's a really nice little poem, very simple. When everything goes all wrong, can you smile and be happy? When your plane is delayed, when you get cancer, that great monk, Kesari Dharmananda, he's got a few books on sale in the library. I saw his doctor in Kuala Lumpur, and he says he's the only man I've ever known who, when I told him that his cancer was terminal, there was no possibility, the only one I've ever known who laughed when I told him his cancer was terminal, he was going to die. Can you do that? You get your results of your biopsy and say, I'm sorry, it's terminal, it's aggressive cancer, and there's no possible cure. Can you laugh? That was a fake laugh, but, you know, a real laugh. Now, that is someone who's impressive. You're going to die anyway, so can you laugh? And this is actually how that really impresses so many people. So that is actually how you can lower expectations of yourself. And if it makes you more peaceful, more happy, a more contented spiritual person, that's really, really impressive. And that will make your friends understand. Anyway, question two, Jaya from Queensland. I expect people to be truthful to me, but I get disappointed with my partner always. It's a big stress to me. I can't make up my mind if I should live with lies. What should I do? This reminded me of a question, again, I was asked in a university in Malaysia some time ago. After giving my talk at question time, this woman stood up and asked for the microphone, and this was her question. She said, this morning I caught my husband lying. He lied to me. I can't trust him any longer. Should I get divorced? That was a question. And so my answer was first asking her a couple of questions. Number one, what are you doing at this university? She said, I'm teaching maths. How long have you been married to your husband? She said, 3 years. I saw my opportunity. I said, let's do some statistics. You're a maths teacher. I know maths. Let's do some stats. 3 years, let's call that 1,000 days. You've been married all that time. Let's say over 3 years on average, averaged over 3 years, your husband has said 20 things to you every day, which could be right, which could be wrong. That's a pretty fair assumption. It's actually quite conservative, probably more than that every day. But let's just call it 20 things every day, which could be right, which could be wrong. So over 3 years, that's 20,000 statements he's made to you. Now he's lied for the first time. According to probability theory, that means the next time he opens his mouth, there's a 20,000 to one chance he's telling the truth. What do you mean? You can't trust him. Now you can see just how I put it that way. If you focus on the lie, then he becomes a liar. And you can't trust him. When you focus on the big picture, yeah, he's told a lie. What about all the truthful things he said? You're not just living with just lies. You're living with so many truthful things. And one or two or three or four lies, I don't know how many. You never destroy the wall because of two bad bricks. You never destroy a relationship because of one or two times your partner's let you down. How many times have you lied, Jaya? And if you say never, then that's another one. So, again, people do lie. The other thing which I've been talking about a lot about lying is, why do people lie, especially to their partner? So don't just say it's bad, I should divorce this person. No, embrace it, incorporate it, learn from it. Why did your husband lie or partner lie? I'll tell you why. It's because he was afraid of telling the truth, or she was afraid of telling the truth, whichever gender it was. And that's a big problem. Because we're afraid of telling the truth, that's why we lie. So to stop all this lying and not saying, you know, how we feel and what we've done, how about removing the fear? So your partner is allowed to say even things which are hurtful as long as he's telling the truth. And he's given amnesty, or she's given amnesty, as long as it's the truth. And please tell your children that. Tell your kids that whatever, if you tell mummy or daddy the truth, no matter what it is, you will never be scolded. I said this last night. There was here quite a few times now, teenage girls have come up to me and said, I'm pregnant. Can you please tell my dad? Why didn't you tell him yourself? He'll kill me if he found out. Or some sort of son gets into trouble with some drugs at school or something. I said, please help. My parents, they would go berserk once they found out. Can you tell them for me? Or get me out of this? And I thought, why on earth are you so afraid of telling your parents? Because they'll kill me. They're afraid. And this is a time when they need their parents most of all. And they won't tell you. They will lie. Because they've been scolded too often. They're afraid. Isn't that a terrible state of affairs? We will lie to our partner because we're afraid of the consequences of the truth. Because we tell the truth and it hurts more. Telling lies hurts less. That's why we tell lies. We want to change that equation. As long as you're telling the truth, it won't hurt. So please, Jaya, tell your partner, as long as you tell me the truth, I will never scold you, I will never punish you. You will always get more value from telling the truth than you'll ever get from lies. And then the lies will stop. At least they will lessen. So it's a waste of time saying you shouldn't tell lies. We should encourage the truth rather than banning lies. Anyway, Victoria from Singapore. Ajahn, I'm having problem with programming mindfulness. My mind doesn't seem to listen. I don't know how to come up with something which is interesting so my mind won't wander so much. Okay, this must be a meditation question. She's wandering all over the place. Instead of meditating, wandering here, wandering there, and programming mindfulness, she's using that as a way of controlling her mind. If you try and control things, you'll find your mind will always wander off. The simile which I give, this is a meditation question, to a wandering mind. The simile of your friend calling you up for a cup of coffee. Suppose your friend calls you up for a cup of coffee and they tell you, are you free this afternoon? You say, yeah, I'm free this afternoon. So now, please come out for a cup of coffee. We won't go to Starbucks, we won't go to Gloria Jean's, we'll go to Dome because that's the one I like. And we won't go to the one in the suburb you like. We want to go to the one in the suburb which I like in Netherlands. There's a very good Dome coffee shop in Netherlands. And when we go there, you know, you won't drink what you like, you know, the sort of the latte which is full of milk and fat. You're going to drink sort of a cappuccino because that's what I like. And you won't have a biscuit, you'll have a muffin. Because that's I like muffins. And we won't talk about your Buddhism. We'll talk about, you know, the sport, which I like talking about. And we'll stay there for 2 hours, because that's how long I want to stay there. And I don't care about you. We're going to stay there in that little corner table, because that's where I like to stay. Now, if somebody talked to you like that, what would your reaction be? Oh, I just remembered I've got an appointment with somebody. Oh, I can't make it. I'm terribly sorry. Is that the way you can invite somebody out? Telling what, where to go, what to do, and what to talk about? Well, that's the way many people control their minds in meditation. We meditate for half an hour. You sit down, not here, not there. You won't sit on a chair. You'll sit on a cushion, because that's why I think you should sit on a cushion on the floor. Only namby-pamby cream puffs sit on chairs. And you keep your back straight and you do breath meditation. Not the meditation you like, body or mind. You do the meditation I like you to do. And we'll do it this way and not that way, okay? Because you're such a control freak, your mind runs away whenever it sees you. That's called the wandering mind. It's had such bad experiences with you. As soon as you try and meditate, you control it so much, your mind is off. Fantasy, asleep, anywhere to get away from you. Now imagine, number two. You call somebody up. Hey, you free this afternoon? Maybe. Do you want to go out for a cup of coffee somewhere? Yeah, I actually prefer a cup of tea. Okay, let's go to a tea shop. Where would you like to go? What would you like to have in your tea? What would you like to eat with it? I'll pay for it. And you sure you want to go there? Not so. Where do you want to sit? What do you want to talk about? You talk about what you want to talk about. Friends like that, you love going out with them. And that's how you should treat your mind. And sometimes you go out with such a friend who just, you know, wants to be caring about you, finding out what you like to talk about, and is interested in you. Friends like that you can spend hours with. Now, if you treat your mind like that, you sit down, mind, what do you want to do? Meditation. Meditation, do you want to dream or fantasize? Do you want to go to sleep? That's fine with me. If you treat your mind with kindness as a friend, not as a slave, you'll find your mind will like to hang out with you. You can stay with your mind. The mind sees you coming. Meditate. Hey, it's Ajahn Brahm again. We've had such wonderful times, Ajahn Brahm and my mind. So it's a wonderful experience together. Yeah, we can hang out for half an hour. How about 2 hours? Yeah, let's go for five. And that's what happens with my mind. You sit there and have a great time together, so we don't want to get out. Now that's the opposite of a wandering mind. You control it, and the mind will run away. You're kind to the mind, sensitive to it, then it will stay with you. So that's the secret of wandering mind. Because you're a control freak. You tell it what to do. You treat it like a slave, which is why it wants to escape. You treat it like a friend with respect, with love, with care, and your mind will stay with you. Because it likes you. So, that's wandering mind stuff. Any questions from Perth, from Dhammaloka Buddhist Center? I have to say this, because you know what happened once? Somebody had their little BlackBerry there, and they actually typed in a question. They knew if it said from Perth, it wouldn't get on. And I think they said from Indonesia. They were sitting actually here, but they routed it through Indonesia, and it appeared on here like Steve from Indonesia or something. They're actually sitting just over there. That's the only way they can get a question asked. So any questions from the floor? Or do you want to see the fireworks? Okay. So, thank you all for listening. We've had the announcements already. We'll just pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha, and then see the fireworks. What is the fireworks for? I don't know. Maybe the end of the world.